You're listening to a podcast with Yoel Halevi and Jono Vandor from Truth to You Radio. For more episodes, you can reach Jono at truthtoyou.org and visit us at hebrewinisrael.net.
You're listening to Truth to You with Jono, and you can download these programs freely from truthtoyou.org. That's truth number two, letteryou.org. And today I am speaking with Yoel Ben Shlomo, the Levite in the land. G'day, my friend.
G'day.
Hey, now listen, we're speaking about, you're going to be telling me about the Temple Mount, right? That's what you've got in mind.
Yeah. There's an ongoing issue for many, many years that I've been dealing with, actually was very active for several years around, is the Temple Mount. I would say the heart of Torah in general being the accepted place to be, the place where you build the temple, and it's not in our hands. Actually, Arabs control it, and they do whatever they want up there. And if you've been following my Facebook page, The Hebrew in Israel, then you will see that I posted lately a few things about this. Because I think this is a place that's not treated correctly. Tourists that go up there have no understanding what they're doing. And in the Jewish world, it's been pushed aside. Jews just don't really care about it. There are many Jews that care about it. Most of the people I used to hang around with cared about it. But there are a lot of misconceptions about the Temple Mount causing it to be pushed aside. Everyone runs to the Western Wall, which is just an exterior wall, saying, oh, this is the place where the Shekhinah, the dwelling of God, still exists. They have no knowledge what's behind it. Well, they know, obviously, when you come to Jerusalem, you'll be able to see what's behind it. But there are a lot of misconceptions when it comes to what it is, how it was built, the history of it, and also the big ongoing debate where exactly was the temple. I even bumped into theories trying to say, oh, it wasn't, this is not the Temple Mount. The Temple Mount was down below in the area of Silwan, which is a big joke. With all due respect, that is one of the most unfounded opinions and unfounded arguments ever to live and surface in our world, because the history of the Temple Mount is actually very well documented. So claiming it's down there based on, I don't know, certain scriptural issues that people have, you know, when you have something concrete in front of your eyes, I think it's a bit difficult to use descriptive corruptions of verses to actually claim something. I met this guy one day. It was really funny. He came to me and he said, I heard you're an expert about Temple Mount. And I said, well, no, an expert, but there's a few things I know. And he pulls out this map and says, well, the Temple Mount is not where you think it is. And I go, okay, here's another one. So he pulls out these maps and everything. And based on a crusade, the name the Crusaders gave a small hill south of the Jewish quarter, they called it Mount Zion, and therefore he decided that's Zion, and therefore that is a Temple Mount. Uh-huh. And I looked at the guy and just smiled and went, you're kidding. No, I'm serious. This is the Temple Mount. And I'm like, you are aware of the fact that that name is from the 10th century. He looks at me and says, well, what do you mean? Obviously, they had a tradition. Not only is it from the 10th century, we actually know what's underneath there. And that was one of the expansions of the city at different points. We kind of know what it is. And the guy starts arguing with me, and I'm saying, hey, listen, you can argue as much as you like. Your only argument evolves around this idea that the Temple Mount is a place called Zion, and therefore you have Mount Zion. That is not the way to go with anything. Because if we do that, we can claim anything about anything in the world if we just decide to call it something else.
Sure.
I don't think that that's the way to go around it.
So I've heard a lot of wacky stories as well, trying to fit the Temple Mount, basically try to fit the Temple Mount or the location of the temple into someone's personal theology. And there's a lot of bending and twisting going on, and it's not unusual to come up with these kind of theories. How well documented, how well is the documented history of the Temple Mount? Are we absolutely certain that that's where it is? And what is the Western Wall? Are we absolutely certain that it is what tradition says it is? Can we touch on those things?
Yeah, of course. This is part of it. So first of all, the Temple Mount is very well documented because at any given stage in history, Jews were in the area of Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the reason the Muslims built the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, I want to clarify something. The Arabs, every time you've seen the news, Arabs saying Al-Aqsa is in danger of this, that. Okay, so how it works is that the technical names the Arabs actually have for the Temple Mount is the entire mount is called Haram al-Sharif. Okay, That's the name of the entire thing. Haram means a holy place. In Russian, for example, a temple is called a Haram, which is kind of interesting. I kept on hearing that word from Russians that came to visit in Jerusalem. And al-Sharif, I'm not sure exactly what Sharif means, but that's basically the holy place or a sanctified place. Now, the Al-Aqsa Mosque means the mosque of the further mosque. Aqsa is like the word kateh in Hebrew, which means the one in the further mosque. Now, in Muslim, the real Muslim tradition, and this is from Muhammad's wife, was that the whole story of him going up to heaven or actually going to Jerusalem and everything was a dream. It was a metaphor. He never actually physically his feet never actually touched Jerusalem. He was never here. It was about 100 years or 80 years after him that the Muslims came to Jerusalem. But the idea was that they asked his main wife, Fatima, what exactly it meant. And she said, well, first of all, he was sleeping. I saw him. She was such a powerful woman in the Muslim world that she was an authority in Muslim law. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of so she said that. She said, yeah, he was sleeping. He never went anywhere. So it was a dream. So the dream was that he went to the further mosque in the heavens. Everyone had some kind of temple in the heavens, including the Jewish world. Everyone has some kind of a temple in the heavens. The New Testament has a temple in the heavens as well. Mm-hmm. Classic thing. Well, the New Testament has it because Judaism has it. Mm-hmm. But all nations always had this thing about a temple in the heavens.
Sure.
You see it in every pantheon, every story of gods or a god. Mm. You have such a thing. So the Al-Aqsa Mosque, if you see a picture of Temple Mount, is that building to the southern corner with like a silver dome. It's not really silver. It used to actually be the color of silver when it was brand new and then just turned black. In that structure, there's a mosque. That's one of the main mosques.
Mm-hmm.
And in that area, there's also what's called the museum. There's a museum, which is basically an anti-Israeli museum where they're trying to show the atrocities of Israel. Mm-hmm. No one actually goes in there these days. Tourists who go to the Temple Mount, they get offered to go see the museum, and most of them decline. They're not interested in going and seeing such a thing. There's like T-shirts there with blood on them. This is the Israeli atrocities, and I remember seeing stones thrown from the Temple Mount onto people peacefully praying on the next to the Western Wall, for example. You know, the Israeli atrocities.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, they actually use the Temple Mount as a podium for almost anything they need to do. And when they're digging underneath the one of the main gates, so actually one of the smaller gates, but the only gate under real Israeli control, They actually said, oh, they're digging underneath Al-Aqsa. The only people digging underneath Al-Aqsa are the Arabs themselves. This is one of the reasons why I started bringing this issue up, because throughout the years, basically from around 2000, the Arabs started digging underneath in what's called the Khulda Gates, in the tunnels of the Khulda Gates, which are ancient gates from the time of the Second Temple. And they just pulled out anything they could and destroyed anything that actually showed that there was a Jewish presence in Temple Mount. They're doing everything they can to hide the Jewish presence. There's a person I know called Tzachi Zweig who was sent in prison to try to protect these things. He goes up there. He does everything he can to document what they've been doing. I've spoken with eyewitnesses that said, yes, they pulled out things which obviously had carvings on them, and they just took a disc and just smoothed out the rock and took it for reuse. It's something the Arabs were doing for centuries here. Most of the Muslim palaces in this area are stones which just were taken from the temple.
Mm-hmm.
These are huge, massive building stones. So the history itself is well documented, and I'll give a couple examples. So when it comes to the structures themselves, so you have the Golden Dome, the Dome of the Rock,
yes.
Also known as Qubbat al-Sahra. Qubba means a dome, Sahra means like the word Sela, a rock. There's a massive rock there, which is about 17 meters on 20, which is a discussion by itself. Why is that rock so big? It's bigger than the Holy of Holies. It's a pretty simple thing to answer, but there's several opinions exactly where the Holy of Holies was. We'll get to that later on.
Sure.
But some of the most important documentations, for example, is the story, how was the Dome of the Rock built? So there was a Muslim historian around the 7th century, living 7th, 8th century, who wrote about when the Muslims came to Jerusalem, conquered Jerusalem, and there was a bit of an argument, was it 686 or was it 676? There was different dates I've seen, but it doesn't really matter. It's around the area of the 7th century. Sure. And they came to Jerusalem, and they went in, and they had different structures here. They had the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is basically just a structure which was reused throughout the centuries. It was a temple for Aphrodite. It was also a temple for other pagan deities. And then it just became the Church of the Holy Sepulchre at the moment. Queen Helena came to Jerusalem and decided what each thing is. And she also discovered the original cross, which is kind of a joke by itself. But she's the one, the description is that she was walking around and with the Holy Spirit, she found things, you know, sorry,
that's funny. Again, historically, documentation has proved her to be a liar basically, hasn't it?
Yeah, but she was a liar and she used it to have power.
Of course.
But that's not the main thing. So when they built the Dome of the Rock, one of the arguments I saw was that they actually built it looking like the Church of the Holy Sepulchre to be a rival of it. Now, why did they build it there? Right? First of all, the Dome of the Rock is not a mosque. Some people pray underneath. Some people pray there, but it's not the official mosque. It's basically a shrine.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason it's there is because this Muslim historian, which at the moment I can't remember his name, but I have everything documented in a file where he describes this man called Kalib, who was a Jew, who was an advisor to this Muslim conqueror.
Mm-hmm.
And when they reached the Temple Mount, he took his shoes off. And he said, okay, you're taking your shoes off. Now I know this is a holy place. So he said to him, what was here? And he said, well, the temple was here. And in the end, based on the Jewish tradition dates back way, way back, he actually showed him the site of the Holy of Holies. Now, some people say, oh, he lied to him. He tricked him. I seriously doubt that.
Mm-hmm.
There was actually a Jewish interest to try to clean up the Temple Mount. The other piece of history was that actually he said originally that the Dome of the Rock will be used by Jews. And Jews for centuries were in charge of cleaning up the place and lighting candles. And it was actually used as a place of prayer for Jews. So that's actually something that, you know, you can argue that, but then there's something which opposes it.
So what you're telling me at some stage in history it was used as a type of synagogue. Is that what you're saying?
Kind of, yes. Kind
okay. All right, that's interesting.
Then basically, so how did he know? So Jews were not allowed into Jerusalem for many, many centuries, but there's an interesting argument in between two bishops in the 4th century that speak about so first of all, Jews, when they were allowed to enter Jerusalem, always flocked to the Temple Mount. So things were still on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
There are actually pictures from the 1920s where you can still see remains of walls, lines on the ground. This is not a paving. This is part of a wall, which starts giving borders. And when a friend of mine looked at these pictures and started measuring things by going to the Temple Mount, it suddenly dawned on him, this thing is the size of the Temple Mount described in the Mishnah. And he showed me these pictures, and we're looking at each other going, is this it? And he says, I do. Because there's like a clear square there that fits the description of the Mishnah, the Temple Mount, of 500 cubits by 500 cubits.
Mm-hmm.
So we know as a fact there were artifacts on the Temple Mount for centuries. And if you go into the Temple Mount, which I've actually done, and you go in, you look to your right, the south, there are these massive columns and tops of columns which are obviously Herodian. So there was a massive building there.
Right.
But again, because of, there's no way of digging up there, so there's no way of actually digging and finding foundations of the temple itself.
Mm.
Because it was just, you try to do that and we're going to have a war on our hands.
Sure.
There was an argument between two bishops, the Bishop of Damascus and the Bishop of Jerusalem. One was called Chrysostomos, the other one was called Cyril, I think. And they argued about a saying inside the New Testament where Jesus says, Yeshua says, you'll see a day where no stone was standing on top of the other. Mm-hmm. And they argued, but we see there's still walls up there. There's still entire structures still up there.
Yes.
So that's another thing by itself. And that basically, you know, that being something on the surface, and Jews always flocking toward Jerusalem, if they were not allowed into Jerusalem itself, there was a ceremony that went on for probably something like 1,000 years where Jews would go to the Mount of Olives and face the Temple Mount. And they always said that's where the temple stood.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just to tackle for a moment, for example, a theory that says the Temple Mount was south of the Temple Mount, more in the area of the village of Silwan. There's an archaeologist called Eilat Mazal, the granddaughter of Binyamin Mazal, who is one of the bigger archaeologists to live in Israel. she's been digging there for years, mm-hmm. and she's been producing surveys and telling us what's underneath there. And it's very, very clear that was part of the city. They found structures there dating to the first temple period, which are clearly not temples. These are dwellings.
Uh-huh.
What's underneath there is known.
Okay.
So it's a very, very difficult target. Temple Mount was there. So the only real candidate for being the Temple Mount is the Temple Mount today. Now, besides that, when you look around the Temple Mount, you can see that this is a Herodian structure. Now, when you look at the description in Josephus regarding the Temple Mount, you see he fortified the walls, he built structures and everything. And when you look at what we do know of the archaeology of the Temple Mount, everything that's been, a lot of it's not everything, but a lot of things have been pulled out from there are from Second Temple period, either stones, artifacts, coins, yes. Arrowheads were discovered as well. Because what the Arabs did when they were digging in what's called King Solomon's stables, which are just really, that's a Templar's name. The Templars gave that name. When they dug through there, they pulled out something like 100 tons of earth. And then they renovated, and then they published a video saying, look, we haven't destroyed anything. And then my friend said to me, yes, we only covered it up. But what they actually did, they pulled out 100 tons of earth, dumped it wherever, and I had several friends who were chasing down the trucks to see where they were dumping it. Today, there's an organization, and if you have the ability to donate to them, please do, because their funding is very, very low, but they're doing a wonderful job in sitting through this. When you come to visit Israel, you actually can go there and take a day to work through this rubble. They give you a pile, and you're just working through the rubble and find things. People have found coins, arrowheads, amazing stuff. Obviously, you can't take it to yourself.
So, hang on. You're telling me these are the people that followed these trucks of earth to where they were being dumped, and it's still today they're sifting through it.
Listen, they've been doing it for about – it took several years until they got the permission to go through it.
Mm-hmm.
But part of the issue was that, for example, Tzachi sat in prison because he went through this rubble, pulled out artifacts, went to his professor, Gabi Barkai, and said to him, look what I found. So he was being provocative because he's proving the Arabs are doing something they're not supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And he was arrested for stealing artifacts. And he sat in prison. He sat in prison for like, was like a 2 week. He sat in for 2 weeks or something. And Gabi Barkai, being a very famous archaeologist, basically went to the government mm-hmm. and said, "Okay, listen. If you don't want us to start exposing this, at least let us go through it."
Sure.
You know, but basically
Arabs and they granted him permission, is what you're saying.
Yeah, in the end, he got permission to do it. So they were allowed to move all the rubble to somewhere else,
mm-hmm.
and they're just going through it. It's on Mount Scopus. You can actually drive there, and there's like this heap there. That okay. Every time they bring a new heap, and they just slowly go through it. So, they've been doing it for years, and they're going through only through 10%.
And because archaeology is an expensive exercise, I mean, to go through something like this, excavations and so on and so forth, it's labor intensive, right? And so what you're saying is that it's definitely something worth donating towards. What is there a website, by the way, that you know off the top of your head?
There is something you can go through. But this, when I find it, we'll try to post it.
Okay, let's do that. If we can get some details, we'll put it up on this post. Okay. So he's found some coins. He finally got
some.
Yeah.
Okay. They found a ton of stuff. They found a lot of things up there.
And so that kind of evidence is fairly conclusive, in as much as that being the Temple Mount.
I think it's quite. I mean, as you know, John, you know me. You know I'm not a conformist. I don't accept everything that people tell me. But here, I think it's quite clear that that's a Temple Mount.
Okay.
It's the only place in the Jerusalem area that actually fits a description. But what one someone can argue is, okay, who says this is the temple that King Solomon, this is the same site of King Solomon's temple? So the answer is, first of all, when they returned to Jerusalem, there were still walls standing.
Mm-hmm.
And there were actually still elders who were teenagers or children in the time of the time of when they returned. They were children in the time of the first temple, and they returned. If you look at the book of Ezra and Nehemiah,
mm-hmm.
it actually describes that they cried because this wasn't as glorious as the structure they originally saw.
Yes.
So they actually knew where it was.
So they recognized it, and they lamented because of its condition. And they rebuilt it. And why would they rebuild it anywhere else but to renovate and rebuild where they know that it is? So that doesn't seem to be in question either. So now, can we just step right back to the beginning and just remind everybody, how did it come to be the site for the sanctuary? How did it come to be the site for the temple?
Okay, so as everyone remembers, in the book of Exodus, we have the tabernacle, the whole description there. I'm actually reworking the issue of the tabernacle because I've noticed a whole bunch of stuff, including, for example, a discussion, what is Olot Tashim? We spoke, and then we said maybe these are skins which are dyed yellow. Yes.
Yep. You know,
so there's a lot of things I'm coming up with. There's a different ideas I've been seeing lately that are making me reevaluate the whole issue of the tabernacle. And for example, the copper altar is the bronze altar is just like there's different opinions exactly what it looked like, etc. So that's a whole thing by itself. So that tabernacle was 40 years in the desert, arrived in Israel. There's a bit of an issue exactly where it sat. They might have sat in one of the Gilgalim for a while. Gilgal was one of the places they stayed at. Historically, we're not 100% sure what happened because in the description in the book of Judges, description in the book of basically Joshua all the way to the end of 2 Samuel, the description there is slightly vague. So what they say in the Talmudic tradition, which probably has there is historical background to that, is that they put the tabernacle in the Gilgal for a while. It might have sat in Shechem for a while as well. But this is not the rabbinical tradition. They say that it says in the end of the book of Joshua, there was a temple of God in Shechem. So that's a whole discussion by itself. I've never found a full answer for that one. But they actually say that it went to Shiloh, and there's actually a site until this very day, which is recognized to be as the site of the tabernacle of Shiloh. And that was actually a stone structure, which they used. They only put a roof on top of it. What's very interesting about the town of Shiloh, so first of all, there's a small town there called Shiloh today.
Yep.
And their synagogue is built to imitate the shape of a tabernacle. I've been there. It's a very interesting thing. They have like, it's like a rectangular, it's not the same size as the tabernacle. They had to make it bigger because it's a synagogue. But it's the same kind of idea. There's a staircase there that looks like, in front of it, that looks like an altar. There's like a little ramp and then an altar, which is really just a staircase. And then there's like this copper lever there where people wash their hands before they go in. And there you go in. There's on the roof, on the ceiling, you have these pieces of cloth to imitate the ceiling of the tabernacle of Shiloh. This is in Samaria. And there's actually a site there which they recognize as being ancient Shiloh, and there's an actual place where they think that might have been the tabernacle itself. So it sat there for a while, then it was destroyed. And then they say the tabernacle moved to a place called Givon, and when you look at King Solomon, there was a big altar in Givon. So it looks as if things started splitting up. The tabernacle went to Givon, the ark was in Jerusalem. But let's go back into the Bible itself, into the Torah itself. It says there, it doesn't say Jerusalem. It says in the Masoretic text, it says the place that God will choose, Asher Yivchar. So the root of the word is Bachar, Bet Chet Resh, and that means to choose. And the Yud in the beginning, Yivchar, is a future form. The Samaritans, on the other hand, and the scholars agree, I think it's over the board that scholars agree that their text has been tampered with. Their text, but what's fascinating is the fact that this is another group that believes in the Torah who have a text extremely similar to the Masoretic text, but also with major differences as well. They believe only in the five books of Moses, and they have a book of Joshua, which is considered to be some kind of a chronicle. It's not considered to be a holy book. With dates and everything. Well, what's fascinating in this group, which was kind of separate from a very, very early stage, separate from the Judeans, have a very similar Torah scroll. And I find that fascinating because this argument of when was the Torah written, here we have a group that from the get-go was completely distinct and completely separate from the Judeans, and they have a very similar text. And when you look at the Book of Kings, it says that a priest from Beth-El, meaning a priest of the northern kingdom, taught them the Torah, which means the Torah was also well known amongst the northern kingdom, or at least some of them knew of the Torah, in a northern kingdom completely separated from King Josiah.
So that's
it's an interesting thing. I start, you know, when you look at it, you go, wait, so you want to argue the Torah was written at the time of King Josiah was written in different sections. And here we have another group that admittedly say we have nothing to do with the Temple of Jerusalem. And they have a Torah very similar to the Torah we have. You know, changes, letters here and there, but the main argument is around the temple. So part of the whole thing of the Wildhausen and all these people who were criticizing the Torah and saying this is documents from different places. And, you know, there was the changes that King Hezekiah did. The discovery of the Torah by King Josiah was a specific game. They sat down, they wrote it down in the book of Deuteronomy. Mm-hmm. It's a priestly writing from the people who believed in Jerusalem. But the Northern Kingdom also had something similar to the book of Deuteronomy. So I think, you know, take that as a fact, for example. We know who the Samaritans are, and their history is well known. And even if we take the history presented in the book of Kings, all the history they claim, they're still from the Northern Kingdom, and they learned from a priest from the Northern Kingdom, which means the Northern Kingdom, the priest of the Northern Kingdom, also had a Torah.
Mm.
Very similar, if not exactly the same as the Torah of Judea.
Yes.
So that kind of pulls out the rug underneath the, at least in my opinion, pulls out the rug underneath the feet of people who want to claim, for example, the book of Vayikra, the book of Leviticus, was a book written by people, by humans. No, it's put out this very, very simple. The Bible doesn't go into all the details of the Torah, from Joshua onwards, because that's not the point. The Torah is written. What needs to be written is written. The other books are there to tell the story or to also warn us of the behavior of our ancestors. So, you know, they had a Torah scroll. But the big argument with them is what is the text there specifically? So their Ten Commandments includes a commandment to go, and the temple has to be built on Mount Gerizim. If you remember, we did the interview about Mount Eval, yeah. Mount Gerizim. So that's a mountain south of Mount Eval.
Yes.
And they claim that they had to build it there, and they changed the text where it says, instead of Makom Asher Yivchal, it says HaMakom, the place Asher, which Yivchal, so chose. This is a past form. This is a Pa'al form, which turns into the past. Ones who learned Hebrew will understand what I mean. So they say, oh, God already chose. He revealed to Moses in the Ten Commandments where the temple has to be. So their claim is that King David rebelled against the Northern Kingdom, which was the chosen kingdom, and this is why the text, you know, you look at what the researchers write, the texts are anti-Ephraim and anti-Joseph because it was Judah finding Joseph. Baloney. Okay, I can't accept that. It doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And it's a real shame that Ephraim and Yehuda are completely separated from one another and fighting over things. It makes me very, very sad that, you know, this great nation of Israel was split into two pieces.
Mm.
And everyone's fighting over who's more important. We're all important. End of story. It doesn't matter.
Mm.
But this issue where the temple should be built is a thing by itself. So they actually have a place there where they do a Passover sacrifice, etc. So they say that there was the temple mentioned in Joshua is the temple they had. And then these Judeans rebelled and built a temple in Jerusalem. Now, there's also an issue exactly the thing about one place of sacrifice. Because if you look through the Bible, they always had these little places of sacrifices all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
So that's explained that when there was no center of religion, then it was allowed to build something, to build your own little temples, your village temples or anything like that. But later on, when there was a center of religion, also known as Jerusalem, then they were told, okay, you have to worship in front of one altar. You have to worship at one temple. And that was very difficult for the Israelites to actually accept, because for hundreds of years, they were sacrificing wherever.
Mm-hmm.
And when the temple was established and it went on for several centuries, we start seeing the prophets talking against having these high places called Bamot or Bama. And they said they were calling them a Bama because if a Bama is basically like a podium. Today, for example, a stage is called a Bama. So basically it's an elevated place. And the Temple Mount, only in the Second Temple period, I would say more like the times of King Hezekiah, who was one of the first kings to really attack this whole high places thing, that's when it became the center of religion. That's when it became like, this. Okay, everyone agrees now. This is the only place to be at. So when they returned the Second Temple period, they decided to rebuild the temple. No one went anywhere else. There was no sacrifice outside of Jerusalem, except for one issue, which was the Elephantine, where there was they say there was a small temple, which was an imitation of the Temple of Jerusalem. And there's also an opinion that says that the Jews of Egypt, the Jews of Elephantine, actually had their own altar there for a very, very long time. And there's actually a letter from the high priest of Jerusalem, which was discovered in Yib, where he tells them to celebrate Passover, and he gives an explanation how to do it. So it seems that there was in the Second Temple period some temple, but wasn't really a rival because it was just too small. No one rushed there. It became unanimous. It really became unanimous in the Second Temple period that this is the place where we're going to have our temple.
Okay, so can I ask you to recap on the obvious though? How did David settle on that particular location? Where do we find that? What was the story behind that?
Okay, so King David brought the ark to where he was.
Mm-hmm.
And which is a very, very, there's a bit of a, I would say, some kind of a political game maybe going on here. I did see a claim like that because he brought the tabernacle to his area way before the choosing of the Temple Mount, unless the storyline there is not exact. That's another issue. We might have a storyline.
We're in 2 Samuel chapter 6, right?
Exactly. He brings the tabernacle. He puts it in a tent in Jerusalem. So first of all, Jerusalem was a Jebusite city, and it was conquered by King David, and he turned it to his capital.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a very interesting theory that says the reason he chose the city of Jerusalem, first it's kind of like in the middle of everything,
mm-hmm.
and it's a neutral city because it wasn't an Israelite city at any stage. Though in the beginning of the book of Judges, it does say that the tribe of Judah together with Simon, I think, they conquered Jerusalem, but it probably wasn't a full conquering, so the city itself remained a Jebusite city. I think it does say it was a full conquering, but they chose up as a Jebusite city again. Mm. So maybe they conquered, left, and the Jebusites came back. I'm not too sure, unless they were called Jebusites because they just sat there and the original inhabitants were Jebusites. Not too sure about that yet.
Okay.
But he comes to Jerusalem, conquers it, starts building up his capital, and he brings the ark to Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. Then we have the story, he tried to bring it twice, one time he put it on a chariot, almost fell, Uzzah touched the ark and was killed on the spot, and then it was moved to someone's house for a while, and then
he was doing so well that that David said, hey, bring it over here. I mean, he did it, he reluctantly, I mean, he was scared of it for a little while after that, wasn't he?
He was scared of it for a very long while.
So he put it in the house of, I forget his name now, but he was blessed.
Yeah,
wasn't he? And he was observing how blessed he was. He rethinks, you know what? I think I can go near. I think this can come near me. I think we can do something a little more permanent now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So he brings it to Jerusalem, puts it in a tent, and the Levites are in charge of making sure its surrounding area is clean and everything. And the priests stay where the sacrifices are. I think it's quite obvious there were also priests in Jerusalem. So it was like the Levites and priests together were taking care of the ark. And then what happens is that he decides, King David at one stage decides to count the people of Israel. And he calls Joab, and he says to him, let's count the people of Israel. And he says to him, oh, may God bless the people of Israel and let them expand like the sand of the shore. And he says to him, no, let's count. And then he realizes he made a mistake, and he decides that he's basically told by a prophet that, but I think it was Nathan, tells him that God gives him three options. To fall in front of his enemies, for starvation for 3 years, a famine for 3 years, fall in front of his enemies for 3 months, or have a plague for 3 days.
Mm.
And he says, I'd rather fall in the hands of the Lord. And he says that bring the plague and the people start dying. Thousands of people die. I think the number is like 70,000 people die or something like that. I can't remember the exact number at the moment. And he suddenly sees an angel with a sword over Jerusalem standing in the area of this hill, which basically was the threshing floor of a king, a Jebusite king,
yes,
who probably decided to forfeit his crown. And because he did that, he was allowed to stay. And he was living on one of the peaks of Jerusalem, and he had the threshing floor. And he says, King David goes to him and says to him, no, I want to buy this piece of land. Oh, take it for free. No, I want to buy it. Mm. There's a bit of a contradiction. In one place, it says that in the book of Samuel, it says he paid 50 silver shekels. In the book of Chronicles, I think it says he paid, 300 golden shekels or something like that. And he builds an altar. And the understanding is that that altar is basically the altar that, in that same spot, King Solomon built the altar of the temple itself. If so, he did or didn't, it's a very, very good question.
So it's originally it was a threshing floor, and a threshing floor is a place where they beat out the grain from the chaff, right?
Exactly. Okay. So he buys a place, he buys the sacrifices, and he builds a sacrifice, and the curse is lifted. The plague is gone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how he knows, okay, this is the place we have to build the temple. Mm-hmm. And they probably put a tent, move the tent up there with the ark, and started sacrificing there as well.
Okay, so it would have become the location of the tabernacle. God said to David, you are not the one who will build me a house, it will come from your son. Eventually it was Solomon who built the majestic and glorious temple as it is described in the Tanakh. And there we have it. But now, do you want to go into any more detail of that, or can I fast forward? I just wanted to jump to Ezekiel, if I could, just to sort of tie this together. Can I do that in Ezekiel chapter 8?
Ezekiel chapter 8. What specifically in Ezekiel chapter 8? Because that's a pretty it's a pretty gruesome chapter where people start dropping dead all over the place.
They do. Well, what I want to do is start from verse 6, and you tell me if we can tie this together. Furthermore, he said to me, son of man, do you see what they are doing, the great abomination that the house of Israel commits here to make me go far away from my sanctuary? Now turn again and you will see greater abominations. And he brought me to the door of the court. Where's that? The door of the court. What's that?
So again, it's some kind of court. When the temple was built, what we know is that the temple was built on a hill.
Mm-hmm.
So they actually describe it as a camel's hump. And if you actually look at the topography, the peak of the mountain is actually underneath the Dome of the Rock. So the rock that sticks out, that's the peak of the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually want to go, put this aside for a second.
Sure.
Because he just made me remember something very, very important.
Sure.
So there's the issue of the location of the temple on the Temple Mount. And the three, basically four different opinions today. We'll get back to Ezekiel when I'm done with this. This is also a very, very important thing.
Mm, sure.
There are four opinions where the temple sat. And this has been going on for years and years and years. So there's a classic opinion that most authorities and most archaeologists and most people agree that is the Dome of the Rock. Mm-hmm. There's a place called the Dome of the Spirits north of that. It's a small dome. There's some kind of little rock inside it that some people say that's the site of the Holy of Holies. There's a thing called the Cup, which is a small fountain. It's a fountain of water. There's a man called Tuvia Sagiv who claims that's the site of the Holy of Holies. I actually met him face-to-face and had a discussion with him. I personally think that he's just trying to push another theory just to get his name out there, mm-hmm. Because his theory is very problematic, because in that specific location, underneath the cup, there's a huge cistern, and there's no way on earth to build anything that big inside that, above that cistern, unless it was underground. And if it was underground, it was flooded all the time. That's mm-hmm. a very, very problematic thing. And then there's a theory that says, oh, the site of the rock is the site of the altar, and the temple was slightly west of that. So let's look at a few things. First of all, the Western Wall, there's a few technical things here we have to look at. The Western Wall, for example, is the exterior wall built by Herod. It's about 486 meters long.
Now, hang on. Did you just say it was built by Herod? Is there a tradition that says that it is an original wall of Solomon's?
No. There's no such tradition, because Josephus clearly describes that Herod expanded the site, and that the style of building there is Herodian, not King Solomon's times. Herodian, okay. Very, very clearly Herodian. There's a few interesting things. There's this gigantic rock that weighs about 640 tons that no one really knows how they got it there. But that's classic of the ancient world. There's a lot of these types of things showing up in different places. But there's a Western Wall. There's a Southern Wall where you have the Chuldah Gates, which are these amazing, you know, there's a set of stairs that goes up to it. And then there's an Eastern Wall. And in the Eastern Wall, when you see it, there's no Northern Wall, by the way. It does not exist. But what's amazing about the Eastern Wall, there are the seams in the wall itself that show the expansion of the wall. So there's a Hasmonean expansion, and then there's a Herodian expansion. But in the center of it, there's actually an ancient section there, which is agreed to be from probably the times of Ezra and Nehemiah. Mm-hmm. So it's actually in the center, and it's actually in parallel to the Dome of the Rock. And everything on both sides is actually added on. Now, besides that, so the Eastern Wall is considered one of the older walls, and actually the tradition used to be, before there was a Western Wall, because the tradition going to the Western Wall was about 500 years old. And it was when the Jews were allowed to go live back in Jerusalem, they weren't allowed on the Temple Mount, but they asked, you know, give us something. So the Suleiman the Magnificent gave them the Western Wall. He gave them this small section and said, this is where you go to pray. Originally, people went on the Temple Mount. People were used to pray the Eastern Wall or the Mount of Olives. So that's a bit of archaeology there. Now, inside itself, most of what we see today is Muslim structures. So when it comes to the topography, remember, topography is very, very important here, because the Temple Mount is actually almost like a camel's hump. So only at the peak you can actually build something. So the only place on the Temple Mount that physically can contain such a large and heavy structure is actually the area of the Dome of the Rock. So the basic understanding is that Dome of the Spirits, first of all, if you position the temple there, part of the temple might probably be outside of the Temple Mount. And the dome itself, we don't even know what it is. It's just there. So someone came up with this theory because it says that there was an eastern gate which faced the Holy of Holies. So there's a gate on the eastern wall parallel to the Dome of the Rock, which people say, oh, that's the original eastern gate. No, that's actually a Roman gate. It was built later on. It does not have any of the characteristics of what they discovered from the Herodian period, as far as I know. I've seen pictures of the inside. I've seen it looks more Roman than anything else. But that's a gate. One of the things an archaeologist showed me was that on the parallel to the Dome of the Rock, there's actually a someone dug there years ago, over 100 years ago, and said there were markings of something was blocked there. Because what we see today, that there's a Muslim graveyard, and they mounded it up so you don't see the entire wall. So there might have been actually a wall there as well. Sorry, gate there as well. Again, it's a bit of an argument because they also plunked a tomb there trying to hide whatever they can. The tomb itself is empty. I heard that someone actually broke into the tomb and said the tomb is empty. It's there just to hide whatever's there. Goodness. And it showed up out of it showed up one day. They deliberately built it there because they realized the Waqf, which is the authority, the Muslim authority on the Temple Mount, put a tomb there because they knew that there was a Jewish interest there. So topography-wise, the Dome of the Spirits is very problematic because it's almost off the Temple Mount. The Dome, the cup itself, again, the same situation. It's too close to the triple portico that Herod built. It's sitting in an area where you can't even build a serious structure because it will crash into the cistern.
Yeah, because it's a heavy, heavy, large structure. It needs a serious foundation, right? It has to be taken into consideration.
And the west of the Dome of the Rock, basically the area, there's a set of stairs there. If you put the temple there, again, you're on a slope and you have to put the temple on these stands and it has to sit in the air half the time. So physically-wise, it's simpler to put the dome, the Holy of Holies on the rock itself. And the fact that the rock is 17 meters by 20, if you remember I mentioned that, is not an issue because it's very clear that the rock wasn't fully exposed if it was exposed at all. Now, there's a thing called the Evin Hashtia, the foundation stone. The word Evin is a stone, not a rock, not a part of a mountain. So it might have been that that rock was completely covered and there was a stone there, which was like a small podium for the ark itself, and that was the Evin Hashtia. Okay, so there's a lot of like these little details here and there that we have to pay attention to. I used to have access to a model of the topography, and it's very clear. We actually made a small scale model of the temple and the altar. We positioned them on the Temple Mount, and I used to show people, you know, this is where you can position. If you take the mountain as a mountain, this is the only place which is strong enough to actually contain such a large structure. And regarding the Temple Mount itself, the understanding is, if you look at the Book of Numbers, I can't actually tell you the exact location. It talks about having to send away anyone who's unclean. So into the Temple Mount, the understanding is, at least the basic understanding is, the holiness is still there. It's an eternal house. So no matter what goes on up there, it's the eternal house of God. So when you go up there, you have to avoid from entering certain areas. So a lot of these Christian tourists, or even people from the Messianic and Hebrew Roots movement, that go into the Dome of the Rock, and they're using the argument in, I think it's in the Book of Hebrews, that Yeshua went in there. And I think that's what it is. If you can help me out with this, because I can't remember exactly how it's understood. There's this whole thing. They say, oh, Yeshua went in there. He wasn't a Kohen, and therefore you're allowed to go there as well.
Are we talking about the Holy of Holies? Or?
Yeah, we're talking about the Holy of Holies. They have this understanding. We're allowed to go in there. Yeah, I'm sorry to tell you, but that's the side of if that's the side of the temple, and you go there when you're unclean, you've defiled the temple.
sure. And the understanding is the tearing of the curtain, the story in the Gospels, and also it goes into some detail and in what you're referring to, the heavenly sanctuary and all of that sort of stuff found in Hebrews. I understand where you're going with that, but the fact remains that if you look at the stipulations in Torah, that it's a very, very dangerous thing to enter the Holy of Holies. One, if you're not the high priest. Secondly, you know, if you're unclean, you are defiled. But of course, it's already defiled, right?
It's defiled, but it doesn't mean you can add to the defilement.
True.
The fact that someone's sinning doesn't mean everyone's sinning. I can do it as well. No, that was the whole thing. How did these people, for example, in time of Ezekiel, we're about to talk about Ezekiel, how did they survive? Because they're the ones who said, "I'm not going to go with the flow. I know this is forbidden, and therefore I'm gonna not go with them."
Mm.
So the fact that you're saying, "Oh, there's no, it's already defiled." No, I don't understand that. Everyone's defiling. I'm going to defile it as well. No, be the one who talks against it.
Amen.
So by the way, so if you look at Numbers 5 verses 1 to 4, it talks about people, you know, having to take people out from the camp. So the basic understanding we're using chapter 5 here in Numbers is that you can go into the Temple Mount even if you're unclean by the uncleanness of the dead. If you wash yourself before you go in, then you're clean enough to at least walk around in the Temple Mount, but not enter the site of the temple itself.
Right.
So to explain the issue of the site of the temple itself, we have to start pulling out diagrams and pictures and giving a whole physical lecture. You have to show pictures of it, which we can't really do over the radio.
No, well, but you did. You had I remember watching a video that you put up on your Facebook page. Maybe you can give me that link, because there was literally a tour of Herod's temple. Do you remember that?
Yeah, yes, but we need more like maps of today.
Oh,
so that's the thing. That's the thing we used to do. So maybe people would listen to this radio. Maybe bump into me before. I used to work in the old city in this little place where we had a model of the Temple of Ezekiel, and I worked there for like 3.5 years, and we used to explain about it. And it might be that someone listening to this show actually might remember this. Mm. Unfortunately, the place shut down. The model was sold, but we, for a very long time, were dealing with the Temple Mount itself. So people always thought we were the Temple Institute. The Temple Institute were one thing. We were dealing with something else. We're dealing with Ezekiel's temple. One possible interpretation of Ezekiel's temple. Again, Ezekiel's temple is very difficult to explain. There's terminology there that we don't really understand what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And we also dealt mostly with the Temple Mount, the history and everything. And I got to meet a lot of people through there, including Rico Cortez, which was kind of funny. He just came in one day and we became friends. It was a very, very important thing to do. And we did create awareness. The problem is that when we spoke with people, a lot of the people I met were completely unaware of it, that you're not allowed to go in there and you're defiling the place. They were unaware, and I had several people saying, "We never knew this. Thank you for telling us." And I started noticing it was kind of like, this is a mission. I have to make sure that people know this, because these were people. These were some of them were Messianics or Hebrew roots people, which I started meeting through this workplace. And these were people who really wanted to follow Torah. And it really shocked me when I started bumping into this, specifically Rico, who was also extremely knowledgeable. And so it was like, thank you for telling. We had no idea. We didn't know we're not allowed to go up there. Again, that there's an issue here of how to divide the Temple Mount. Again, there's an issue of maps and everything, which I can't really explain here. But the Temple Mount is divided into several sections. But if you're walking in the exterior section where Herod expanded the mountain, then you're fine. And that's what most of the Orthodox Jews who do go up to the Temple Mount, that's what they do. They go to the mikveh, and then they go to the Temple Mount, and they make sure that they take their shoes off and they walk around. There's areas that they won't go into, and there are areas that they do go into. But it's in the ultra-Orthodox mind, you know, to go up there, it's too holy, and they actually push the Temple Mount out of the Jewish agenda. Mm-hmm. And now, for years, many of us have been working trying to tell people, no, you must not push it out of the agenda, because this is the heart of things. If we ignore this, there's no point of being in the land, because this is the key.
True. Fair enough. Now, speaking
of... Jerusalem holds the city in the country.
So people defiling the site, going up there, and the situation that it's in today, again, that brings me back to Ezekiel chapter 8. Can we talk about that briefly?
Yeah.
Okay, so, I mean, it's talking about abominations in the temple, right? And God is saying to Ezekiel, look at this, and look at this, and it gets worse, and look at this, and it gets worse, and look at this. And as I was reading from verse 6, furthermore, he said to me, son of man, do you see what they are doing? The great abominations in the house of Israel, what they commit here to make me go far from my sanctuary. Now turn again, you'll see even greater abominations. And so he brought me to the door of the court. And when I looked, I saw there was a hole in the wall. And he said to me, son of man, dig into the wall. And when I dug into the wall, there was a door. And he said to me, go in and see the wicked abominations which they are doing there. So I went in and I saw, and there every sort of creeping thing, an abominable beast, and all the idols of the house of Israel portrayed all around the walls. And there stood before me 70 men of the elders of the house of Israel. And in the midst stood, how do I pronounce this guy?
Yezniyahu.
The son of Shaphan. Each man
It's Ya'azaniyahu. It's a kind of a difficult name, Ya'azaniyahu.
Yeah, that is. Each man had a censer in his hand, and a thick cloud of incense went up. And he said to me, son of man, have you seen what the elders of the house of Israel do in the dark? Every man in the room with of his idols, for they say Yehovah does not see, Yehovah has forsaken the land. And he said to me, turn again, you'll see even greater abominations. And so he brought me to the door of the north gate of the Lord's house. To my dismay, women were sitting there weeping for Tammuz. And then he said, have you seen this, O son of man? Turn again, you'll see greater abominations than these. And so he brought me to the inner court of the Lord's house. And there at the door of the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 men with their backs towards the temple of the Lord and their faces towards the east. And they were worshipping the sun towards the east. Now,
Every time I read that verse...
Yeah,
it reminds me of it. It reminds me of what the Muslims do. They pray to the south, but there's many pictures where you see them. They're bowing to the south and basically have their rear ends towards the temple.
Right. So, is it fair to is it fair to speculate that this is what Ezekiel is seeing? Is that what it is? I mean, is it the abomination of the Muslim domination on top of? On the temple.
Oh, no, no. He's talking about the actual abomination of what the Judeans were doing. This is not a future prophecy. This is now. This is like as if it's happening now.
So
he's describing, this is what's going on in Jerusalem. Look what they're doing in my house.
This was the children of Israel, and this was the way at the time the what was actually going on there in the present for Ezekiel.
Exactly.
But God was showing him in a vision what was happening there. In that very day.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah. It was showing exactly what was going on, and he's telling, look, this is what they're doing in my house. Look at this.
So the question becomes, the state of the Temple Mount today, I mean, the temple isn't there now, but the state of the Temple Mount and the way that it is treated, and as you have said, it's still a holy site, but the way that it is treated, is it not similar to the abominations in the temple that God has shown Ezekiel?
I mean, so let me give you a few descriptions that a few things I've seen with my own eyes. Children play soccer up there next to the Dome of the Rock. There's a soccer field. It's very unclean. There's dirt all over the place. They sit there and have picnics. See, under the trees have picnics. You know, they spit on the floor there. There's garbage everywhere. Desolation of anything that might say there were Jews there. The Temple Mount is not really a holy site. I want to see a Muslim play soccer next to the Kaaba in Mecca, who'll be killed.
Mm. So what you're saying is there's absolutely no reverence for the site at all. There seems to be no consideration for the
only reason they care. The only reason they care is because there's a mosque there, and it was Haji Amin al-Hussein in the 1920s who brought up this idea that this is the third holiest site for Islam. It was not. They couldn't care less. But there was an issue there. One of the issues with Jerusalem, there were actually several places which were which are sacred to Islam. One's Mecca, the other one's Medina. The third one, the idea of it becoming holy had to do with a war in between the Ottoman Empire and the center of Islam in Saudi Arabia, where the people who started originally pushing the idea of the Temple Mount being a holy site for Islam were the Ottomans, where they were trying to say, oh, we want our own center of religion, we also want our own center of power, and they started pushing the Temple Mount as being the holy site. First of all, in Islam, originally, Muhammad wanted the Muslims to pray to Jerusalem, and when the Jews rejected his belief, they said, okay, I don't care about the Jews anymore, because originally he wanted to attract Jews to his new religion. Religion equals money and power. That's really what it was. So instead, when he realized the Jews weren't interested, he said, okay, I'll go to the center of religion for the Arabs, because he was an Arab, and the Arabs originally just sat in Saudi Arabia. So they're actually one of the most conquering nations in the world. They took over North Africa and basically this entire region. This region of Israel, Jordan, Syria, had nothing to do with Islam, had nothing to do with the Arabs. They're the most conquering nation in the world. They've gone into many countries and spread their beliefs and also spread their own culture and their genetic material in these places. But for example, the Syrians are not Arabs. They're not really Arabs. They consider to be Arabs, but they're not. It's like going to Azerbaijan and saying, "Oh, the Azerbaijanians are Arabs." They're not. They're Asians. It's like going to whatever country. You go to Malaysia and you say, "These are Arabs." No, they're not Arabs. These people are just Muslims, but they're Malaysian. So so it was a political fight. And when the Jews said, "We're not interested," he went to Mecca. But originally, the Kaaba was a house of idols.
Mm.
It's a very, very old structure, and it was used as a house for idols. And then he decided that now it's a house for worshiping of one God.
Mm.
But the practices they have in Islam when they go to Mecca are a continuation of practices which were done by pagans. For example, they have the three pillars of the devil, where they throw rocks at it.
Three pillars.
If you've ever learned some of the ancient pagan religions, there was a practice of having three pillars, basically two standing on one on top of the rest. Almost like what you have in Stonehenge, and they used to throw rocks at it as a form of prayer. That's an example. Mm-hmm. Muslims have a lot of practices which are still very, 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 very old and still very into the pagan mindset they came out from.
Well, in any case, you only have to go to Ezekiel chapter 40 to see that there is a new temple that is built and a functioning one at that. And may it be soon.
Amen. So actually what we learned from Ezekiel is that it's important to know about the temple, and with all due respect, you see from Ezekiel that the temple will be rebuilt and there are sacrifices.
Yes.
We're going to start arguing about the minor detail, the small details there, is that if there is an ark, there isn't an ark, there is an altar of incense, that's irrelevant. If we're talking about the issue of sacrifices, it's very, very clear there are sacrifices in Ezekiel's temple. How do we correlate Ezekiel with the rest of the Bible, with the book of Leviticus? Is already another issue by itself. One thing we do see in Ezekiel, if you do believe in prophecy and you believe the book of Ezekiel is a book of prophecy, then you have to admit that there will be sacrifices.
Mm-hmm. Yep, most certainly. So it will be rebuilt and it will be functioning, and Levitical priesthood will be functioning there, and there will be sacrifices. And so simply because of that, should we not be treating the Temple Mount with an immense amount of reverence? I think so.
I think so too. Yeah, when we went up there, we were very, very careful. We dressed in very nice clothing. When I went up with my friend, and we made sure we walk in with the in the most revered way. And I actually, when I walked in, it was an interesting mix of an emotion, because when you go in and you're used to saying you know how to go up there and everything, so you go in and you kind of like lose yourself for a second, because you go, wow, I'm actually on the Temple Mount. But there's also an atmosphere there that I could not explain. I go in and I felt as if there's something there that I'm supposed to fear, but that I am supposed to be there. It was a very, very strange feeling. As Nehemiah said, I'm very litvish about things. My emotions are actually very under control, but this was a very, very strange sensation when I actually walked in. You walk in through the gate, and it's as if you walked into something completely different. It was very, very strange.
My goodness. Well, my friend, let me just say thank you for giving us all of that information, particularly in regards to, as we've just ended, taking into consideration the reverence that we should have when visiting Israel. If we're going to visit the Temple Mount, it's important that we know about these things. And so thank you again for your knowledge. We've been speaking with Yoel Ben Shlomo, and you can find his Facebook page. It's Hebrew in Israel. And also, if you are looking for Hebrew lessons, now I know you don't have much room left, but I'm just going to give them the Gmail address anyway.
Thank God, I don't have time.
You can try. The email is HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. But my friend, thank you for coming back on the Truth to You and explaining to us the temple and the Temple Mount.
You're welcome.
Excellent. All right. Until next time. Dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.